right, good evening, Truth Seekers. How you doing? Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. Thanks for joining us this evening. Yeah, I had to take last Friday off. I felt like I was like my vocal cords had migrated to the bridge of my nose. Ah, but we're back. Full of piss and vinegar once again. David Ray Griffin, Dr. David Ray Griffin, will join us in our second hour tonight. That should be interesting. Have we had him on before, Kathy? Long time ago, yeah. We also have some audio clips from two first ladies tonight. The current first lady, Laura Pickles Bush, wagging her finger at the government's response to a horrific natural disaster. No, not Hurricane Thumbelina or whatever she called Katrina, but over the cyclone, read hurricane, that struck Myanmar. And, well, you got to hear this. You won't believe it. You won't believe it. And Senator Hillary Clinton appearing on Bill O'Reilly's program over the weekend, that's bad enough. But she explains Barack Obama's elitism while saying, God bless us rich people. Why do you hear that? Oh, I know, it's totally out of context, right? Well, you decide. Anyway, it's been kind of a surreal news cycle with these two women. I had time to read or to watch. Read? Me? I gave that up a long time ago. I had time to watch a couple of DVDs over the weekend, thanks to the generous support from a friend. One of them was 9/11 Mysteries, and it from 911mysteries.com. It's part one called Demolitions. And I'll tell you something. I don't see how anyone, and I mean this, how anyone can accept the collapse of those three buildings at the World Trade Center as coming as a result of the plane hitting two of the three buildings. It's just astonishing. We may get into that a little bit with Professor Griffin tonight. We shall see. Remember last week when Hillary was floating around the internet and television kind of jive-ass and joshing with her supporters to put a little money on the filly? Hey, I want all of you to bet a little bit of money on the filly in the Kentucky Derby. And referencing the horse and herself as the only filly in the presidential race. And you know what happened to Eight Bells. Turned out to be the kiss of death for the poor horse. I don't know. All of a sudden, I'm just so morally opposed to horse racing. I really am. And if you're a supporter of horse racing, don't email me, please, because there are much more important things. But years ago, when I lived in Tampa, I used to go to the Greyhound track and bet money. Parimutuel betting, same as thoroughbred racing. And it never crossed my mind until 5 or 6, what an ass I was being, until about 5 years later when I started reading about what happens to the greyhounds from the dog tracks. And I became, just opposed. I don't mean I carry signs and picket and petition, although I probably should, against the use of greyhounds that way. But thoroughbred racing now over the past couple, 3 years has started to affect me the same way. It's hideous to take an animal like that and put someone on its back. Granted, a little someone, and race with the clear possibility the horse is going to trip and fall and break a leg and have to be murdered on the spot. And if the horse doesn't do what the jockey thinks it should be doing, out comes the whip. So, and why is this? For the benefit of the people who love horses? I don't think so. I think it's more for the enjoyment, the perverse pleasure of gamblers. And the egomaniacal attitudes of the people who own the stables who produce the horses. I watched some of the video coverage once it became a news item, other than the fact that Big Brown won. Was it Big Brown? Is that the name of the winner? Other than the fact that that horse won, the news item, of course, was the death of the second-place horse. But before it was revealed, the second-place horse had to be euthanized on the track. The video camera was all over the owner's box of the ones that owned the winning horse. And these people were acting as though World War II had just ended, and they were the ones who were responsible. I don't know. The foibles of the rich have always just struck me as reason to put them all down. Really, I can't get my mind around that. You know, a bunch of people, well dressed, extremely well dressed people. Most of the women in very low cut gowns. Did you notice that? You know, high fiving, back slapping, squeezing, and hoorahing over the fact that their horse won a race. And of course, they had nothing to do with that. They're not the jockey. They're not the trainer. They don't decide on the conditions of the track. They're not the veterinarian. They don't decide on the diet of the horse. They don't exercise the horse. They are just the wealthy owners of the horse. Oh, Christ. I don't know. Forget it. There's something that's readily apparent about this story that gives me the shivers in a good kind of way. This, according to the Associated Press, Iran rejects nuclear inspections in their country unless Israel allows them in their country. How do you like that, huh? An Iranian envoy said today that his government will not submit to extensive nuclear inspections while Israel stays outside the global treaty to curb the spread of atomic weapons. Remember, there are only a couple of countries on Earth that are not signatories to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. North Korea is one. Israel is one. I guess there's a couple more. Didn't we say we're out of there? I mean, we were a signatory, but hasn't Bush crapped all over that one, too? I think he has. The ambassador to, excuse me, to this non-proliferation treaty meeting from Iran said, quote, "The existing double standards shall not be tolerated anymore by non-nuclear weapon states." There are apparently more than 30 countries still without a comprehensive safeguard agreement with the IAEA to ensure cooperation with the UN regarding that treaty. Israel doesn't discuss whether or not it has atomic weapons, which is no longer coy. I mean, come on, Israel, for God's sake. They won't discuss it. But they did not sign the treaty, which requires all signatory countries, except the ones who already have them, to refrain from obtaining nuclear arms. India and Pakistan also are not signatories. Iran did sign, and because of that is under UN Security Council sanctions meant to pressure their government into allowing inspectors who will ensure it isn't developing nuclear weapons. Now, Iran keeps saying, look, it's peaceful. And the IAEA so far has agreed it's peaceful. But a U.S. envoy to this hearing accused Iran of what our government calls provocative and destabilizing activities. Oh, really? Provocative? Oh, Iran is guilty. Oh, I see. And what exactly has Iran done? I'll wait. Crickets. Yeah, that's what I thought. Our envoy said Iran's leaders were responsible for leading the country into the sanctions imposed by the Security Council. Our envoy, Christopher Ford, Special Representative for Nuclear Nonproliferation, said, quote, "The path of defiance," referring to Iran, "is also the path of isolation, of continuing and additional sanctions, and of further stunted economic opportunities for proud and sophisticated people already suffering from economic turmoil and mismanagement by its regime's leaders," end quote. But you talk about, I guess the word I can use on the radio is cojones, telling Iran that, you know, you're being provocative and warlike while we are surrounding their country and getting ready to pounce. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
listening to Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio. Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
21 past the hour. What would you say would be the single biggest among just hundreds of examples, the single biggest domestic policy failure of this corrupt, filthy regime of George W. Bush's? Well, it would be arguably the Katrina, the response, the lack of response to the Katrina disaster. What are we coming up on, 3 years now? And it was just horrifying. No response at all. The cyclone or the hurricane that hit Myanmar, or as Laura Bush refers to it, Burma, the cyclone that hit Myanmar the reports now are saying in excess of 10,000 dead. It may go as high as 20,000, way beyond what anyone thought at the beginning. Burma, as Laura Bush calls it, is run by a military junta, which I'm sure causes her husband just all sorts of sexual excitement thinking about, I wish I could do that, Pickles. And she made a statement today. She called on the rulers of Myanmar to took them to task for failing to warn the citizens of that country in time about this killer storm. And she is saying the junta that runs Myanmar should accept U.S. aid in the disaster's wake. A quote, she said, "It's troubling that many of the Burmese people," again, she refers to them as Burmese or Burma, "learned of this impending disaster only when foreign outlets such as Radio Free Asia and Voice of America sounded the alarm." Kind of like in this country when NBC and MSNBC and CNN sounded the alarm. Huh, Pickles? Now, for some reason, Laura Bush has taken what is referred to as a leading role in shaping U.S. policy toward Myanmar. why? I mean, for what reason? She said that Washington, in her words, stands prepared to increase its assistance well beyond the initial emergency $250 million that the U.S. Embassy in Yangon, that she calls Rangoon, offered. She declined to give a precise dollar figure on this aid, but she said the junta first had to allow a U.S. disaster assistance response team into Myanmar to assess the scope of the devastation from the cyclone. Oh, yeah, that's going to happen, Pickles. A disaster assistance response team? Made up of what? Navy SEALs and private contractors from Blackwater? Yeah, okay, sure. When asked about how much money would go, she said, "I can't speak to how large the assistance would be, but I feel assured that it would be substantial." One word for you, New Orleans, Louisiana, on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, that part of the world, as your husband refers to it, when you're going to take care of that? Here she is. Here's Pickles. It's odd that she pranced to the podium in the White House briefing room today to discuss this disaster in Myanmar anyway. Even stranger, as I mentioned, was her admonishment of the government of Myanmar's failure to warn its citizens of the impending danger. You know, there's a storm coming. And this is so ironic, given the crappy U.S. response to Katrina, which she called variously Karina and Karenna twice during the aftermath. But our favorite response here at the Malloy Program from Princess Valium in the Katrina aftermath was when she fretted over the state of children. Remember, who had lost their parents during the storm, or mothers whose children were missing? Because, as she said at the time, quote, "We all know what it's like to lose your kids in the grocery store. So, you know what they're going through," end quote. That's how the Bush crime family and the people who sit in the boxes at the Kentucky Derby, that's how they relate to the rest of the world. Well, you know, you lose your kids in a grocery store, it's awful. Pickles, these are men and women who lost their children to something called death. You might remember George's sister. I guess you weren't allowed to talk about it. Okay. So anyway, this callous, sedated twit of a first lady dares to criticize another nation's disaster response after what she and her husband and the rest of these bastards failed to do. Why not get it over with and unleash a battalion of Blackwater thugs to attack the survivors over there who are digging through the rubble and looking for food? Huh, Pickles?
As they cope with this tragedy, the men and women of Burma remain in the thoughts and prayers of many Americans.
Oh, good.
It's troubling that many of the Burmese people learned of this impending disaster only when foreign outlets such as Radio Free Asia and Voice of America sounded the alarm.
Oh.
Although they were aware of the threat, Burma's state-run media failed to issue a timely warning to citizens in the storm's path.
That's familiar.
The response to the cyclone is just the most recent example of the junta's failure to meet its people's basic needs.
Wow, who knew Brownie worked for the Myanmarese now? I know, let's send them some formaldehyde-laced trailers. You want to do that, Pickles? Sit down and shut up. Go back to counting out your tablets. See how many you got left till the end of the month. Oh, my God, you got a wedding coming up. You know, go sniff something. You know, just, you're going to talk about Burma? why not, if you're going to refer to Myanmar as Burma, why not refer to the United States as the colonies?
It's good to see, be able to look in people's eyes and not see them all bloodshot.
Which was one of my favorite lines of his pregnancy. Oh, I'm sorry, his presidency. It is 25 before the hour. Now, from one soon-to-be former first lady to another, this one, Hillary Rodham Clinton. Hillo appeared on Billow's program to explain why Barack Obama's an elitist and how she is in touch with the middle class. I've just about had my stomach full of this senator from New York. I really have. This... not just the vacuousness of the things that she says, the formulaic way she approaches her answers. You know, we've heard this. We've seen this. I think that's why so many people support her. It is comfortable, just like any kind of chronic illness can become comfortable after a while if you learn how to make sure your meds are in proper adjustment. And But listening to her is driving me insane. She and McCain insist on this half-witted gasoline excise tax holiday that will save you and me roughly $10 a month over a three-month. Jesus, God, and she won't let it go, even when economists point out to her the idiocy of the whole idea. Please, please, will the people of Indiana put her out of her misery? Ooh, that's what happened to the filly. Oh, never mind. So she goes on Bill O'Reilly's program. God. And if appearing on Fox wasn't bad enough, she also exclaimed during the interview, and you'll hear it. I think you'll hear it. Yeah, you'll hear it. God bless us, rich people. We deserve all the opportunities to make sure our country and our blessings continue into the next generation. That's right, but Barack Obama is the elitist for saying rural poor people are disillusioned and bitter because of the mistreatment they've received from the Bush cabal and the previous Clinton cabal and the Bush cabal before that and the Reagan cabal before that, right? God bless us rich people. You go for it, Philly.
Before I vote for you, I want to know exactly how much you're going to take out of my wallet, all right?
I'm going to take
you got six and a half.
You were paying in the 90s, and as I recall, you did pretty well in the 90s.
Six and a half, okay.
I learned a lesson from Ronald Reagan. In 1980, when he was elected, our Social Security system was in a mess. The Democrats weren't agreeing, and a lot of the Republicans were nervous. So Speaker Tip O'Neill, another great American politician, the two of them, the two Irishmen, got together and said, let's have a commission. Because the only way we're going to fix this is if everybody said, hey, we got to make some changes. I am not going to raise the payroll tax on people who are already paying more than
they should. I could pay it on every nickel I make.
I am not in favor.
That'd be another eight.
What?
I am not in favor of lifting the cap. That's Senator Obama.
Oh,
I am not in favor of lifting the cap.
Okay, so you're going to keep it at 109?
We're going to see what happens here.
All right. So you're kind of waffling here.
No, I'm not waffling. I'm saying I'm not going to impose additional burdens on middle-class families. And
but I'm not a middle-class family. I'm a rich guy.
And you know what? Rich people, God bless us. We deserve all the opportunities to make sure our country and our blessings continue to the next generation.
Oh, please excuse me while I vomit. The 109, O'Reilly and Clinton talk in the shorthand only two swine like this would understand. So you're going to keep it at 109. That's the cap, of course, $109,000 individual tax on or individual earnings. Beyond that, you don't pay Social Security. It's incredible. And so she says, no, I'm not in favor of lifting the cap. That's Senator Obama. And that's also why your ass is not going to be the Democratic nominee for president, Mrs. Clinton. I'm not in favor of lifting the cap. So she says, all right, so you're kind of waffling here, right? No, I'm not waffling. I'm saying I'm not going to impose additional burdens on middle-class families. Middle-class families. Mrs. Clinton, the median income in this country, I think, is $60,000. People in yours and Bill O'Reilly's tax bracket, honest to God, lady, are not considered middle-class. They really, really aren't. An individual who makes $109,000 a year, regardless of how that has been destroyed by George Bush, that is not considered to be a middle-class income. It really isn't, Hillary. Honest to Christ, it's not. And people whose net worth is over $100 million are not considered to be normal, average, middle-class people, Hillary. Honest to Christ, they're not. Don't you know that? Can you play the last part? I just want people to hear that. Can you get that part where he says, but I'm not a middle-class family, I'm a rich guy? And her response to that?
All the opportunities to make sure our country and our blessings continue to
No, a little bit, back from that. Go back some more. Go back some more. Go back some more.
Middle-class family, I'm a rich guy.
All right, go back some more.
Class families, and there
are
a lot of
people. But I'm a middle class family. I'm a rich guy.
And you know what? Rich people, God bless us. We deserve all the opportunities to make sure our country and our blessings continue to the next generation.
And Barack Obama is the elitist. From is it time for another break? No, it's not time for a break. I thought I heard some music. My bad. Our resident philosopher writes, hey, Mike, I found this on Crooks and Liars this morning. Quote, after almost 8 years of G-Dub and 6 years of total Republican control, there's not one single policy they can point to and say, this was a success. Now, I know, Bob writes, this isn't news to you, me, or anyone who listens to your program, or anyone who's paid any attention since Inauguration Day 2001, or anyone who can pass a simple reading comprehension test. I'll stop short of saying anyone who can fog a mirror. Isn't it absolutely strange, weird, and uncanny that this simple fact has gone unreported by the mainstream media? The Republicans cannot point to one single policy over 8 years and say this was a success. The thousands of people toiling away in the print and broadcast media have not been able to somehow let the American people in on this little straightforward, uncomplicated, plain reality. Brian Williams and his ilk have never looked straight into the camera and said, after almost 8 years of the George W. Bush administration and 6 years of complete Republican control, there is not one single policy they can point to and say, this was a success. The sentence is without one shred of editorializing, completely devoid of bias, and quite simply the honest reporting of the truth. There is not one single policy they can point to and say, this was a success. This to me says everything I need to know about the state of the art of the mainstream media in the United States. To take this to the next level of bizarre but true, why haven't Obama or Clinton looked straight into the camera and said, after almost 8 years of the George W. Bush administration and 6 years of complete Republican control, there is not one single policy they can point to and say, this was a success. Why didn't John Kerry say a modified version of the same thing in 2004? Why does any Democratic candidate for any office not hammer home the same point? Republicans, they haven't succeeded in anything. They failed in everything. Vote for me. The bar is so low now, Democrats should be able to win in a landslide by holding up a picture of the Republican opponent in front of the voters and say, see, I'm not that guy. Vote for me, because I'm not that guy. But for some reason, completely unknown to me, we're stuck in this creaky, slimy process of role-playing where telling the truth would make somebody somewhere uncomfortable. So to spare these unknown people's feelings, candidates dance around the truth while the rest of us become apathetic to their message. If just one candidate would not speak truth to power, just speak truth to voters, that would galvanize everyone across the board. And the media would have to report that. It'd be news, wouldn't it? Anyway, got to go. There's a new cable 24/7 news station I want to watch. It's called J-Right. All Jeremiah Wright, all the time. I don't know what the ratings will be because according to Arbitron television audience estimates, African Americans scare the crap out of white Americans. See ya, Bob. Yeah, and I'm sure Crooks and Liars and Bob Alexander and certainly this program will offer that slogan to any Democratic candidate who is serious about shaking the bushes to let people know that the rats residing therein, the Republicans, have done nothing, after almost 8 years of Bush and 6 years of total Republican control. There's not one single policy they can point to and say, this was a success. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. So what's all the other superfluous, nonsensical, wasted talk about?
Well, I only hope it's money, it's a pitch, girl. It's going too far, because you know it don't matter anyway. High and dry, high and dry, you're out of the rain. It's so easy to hurt other men that can't feel pain. Don't you know that a pain grows? If it's too much to give, cause you'd rather live for the thrill. Oh, you're a rich girl. You're going too far, as you know it don't matter anyway. A bitch, girl. It's going too far. Enough.
Day after day, I'm more confused.
Do not go gently into that good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey, right? With Mike Malloy.
You know that's a game that I hate to lose.
We have some more Clinton stuff coming up a little bit later in the program. But David Ray Griffin will be joining us in about 15 minutes, so stick around for that, all right? Prairie 2 writes in about the straight dope, as he puts it, on horse racing. He writes, hey, Mike, the U.S. is the only country where horses collapsing during races is a common occurrence. Unlike the rest of the civilized world, the U.S. allows horse trainers to run their horses on painkillers. A horse in pain won't run very fast. The weak horses that survive doping are then put out to stud, reinforcing the weak gene. It's gotten so bad over the last 20 years that a typical horse now runs an average of 6 races a year instead of 10 for fear they will not survive. It's simple, short-sighted greed. Mr. Ed says, just say no to drugs, Wilbur. Okay. Thanks, Prairie 2. John McCain is, I mean, how much longer is mainstream media going to cover his ass for the insanity that that he comes up with? Well, apparently forever. And his two spiritual advisors, John Hagee, Pastor John, and who's the other one, that crazy one, Parsley? I know it's some vegetable. Rod Parsley and Pastor Hagee. We're going to try to get to that tonight, too. Doubt if we can. But at a town hall event last Friday, McCain implied or spoke the truth that the U.S. went to war in Iraq over oil. He did. He said, now, before you think, well, gee, that's sure straight talk. Well, just keep in mind that that's okay with him. He doesn't give a damn. But he just stated it categorically. We went to war in Iraq over oil. He said that if America had energy independence, that would, quote, prevent us from having ever to send our young men and women into conflict again in the Middle East, end quote. If America had energy independence, we wouldn't have to send our young people into the Middle East into battle. Uh-huh. And later, on his campaign plane, according to what I have here, McCain tried to clarify his remarks, claiming that he was really talking about the first Gulf War. which, does that make sense to you? He was pressed by a reporter. McCain stumbled and when asked if he was actually thinking about the first Gulf War when he made the statement. And when specifically asked by an Associated Press reporter if, when he made the statement, he was, quote, thinking about the first Gulf War, end quote, he said no. Here's what he said. No, my friends, I was thinking about, it's not hard to, we will not, by eliminating our dependency on foreign oil, we will not have our national security threatened by a cutoff of that oil because we will be dependent, because we won't be dependent, we will no longer be dependent on foreign oil. That's what my remarks were. Oh, well then, it all comes clear. And some of you Clinton supporters and Obama supporters are still insisting that if your candidate doesn't get the Democratic Party nomination, you're going to vote for this freak? Well, shame on you if you do. Just shame on you. Shame on you. If you're a Democrat, in the current sense of that word, if you're a Democrat in the current sense of that word, you will vote for whomever winds up with the nomination, no matter how rigged it is, no matter how false it is, no matter how non-reflective of the needs of this country that candidate may be. Doesn't matter. If you are a Democrat, you will vote for the Democratic Party nominee, right? Now, you may not want to be a Democrat under those conditions. Okay, then stop being one. Go become an independent. Don't become a Republican. Suicide would be more honorable at this point in our history. But if you are going to be a little whiny ass about your Barack Obama or your Hillary Clinton, to the extent that, you know, you're walking around right now, well, if she gets it, I'm voting for McCain. Well, if he gets it, I'm voting for McCain. Well, then, okay. Why? Why do you want to very... artfully, or not artfully at all, lift your chin and slide a rusty razor across your throat? Why do you want to do that? Now, if you can't handle whomever the Democratic nominee happens to be, good for you. Good for you. Then vote for someone else. But don't vote for McCain. Are you insane? Don't be that petty. Don't be a child. Don't be a kindergarten kid. Honest to God. I mean, do whatever you want. It's your vote. I'm just sitting here preaching a little bit. because I see this all the time. I hear this all the time. And I see the polls. Was it 40% in this state say if Hillary gets a nominee, the Barack Obama supporters are going to vote for McCain, and 38% in this state say the opposite, and 27% over here, and 52%. You know, if that's how petty you really are, then you deserve 8 more years of Republican chaos, don't you? Huh? Oh, it gets very, very difficult sometimes to try to maintain. I understand. Try to maintain any kind of sanity in this putrid political system that has devolved, thanks to Republicans, thanks to corporatism, into what it is. Voting machines that belong to Republicans, programs that belong to Republicans, proprietary information that you and I will never see. The man considered by many to be the most respected leader of the 9/11 truth movement, Professor David Ray Griffin, joins us after the break. Stick around, okay? I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M. Welcome back. It's about 7 past the hour. Professor David Ray Griffin is considered by many to be the most respected leader of the 9/11 truth movement. He is a professor emeritus at the Claremont School of Theology, where he taught for over 30 years. He's authored or edited over 24 scholarly books. And he was initially very skeptical of claims of a major cover-up around 9/11, but he became convinced, apparently, of a major cover-up because of his individual research, I would assume. We're going to find out in a minute. Putting aside all of his work in theology, he then devoted himself to writing The New Pearl Harbor, which came out in 2004, which presents a powerful account questioning the official story of 9/11. Following the publication of the government's 9/11 Commission Report, Professor Griffin published a second highly compelling book, titled The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. In 2007, Professor Griffin published his most remarkable book on 9/11, Debunking 9/11 Debunking, which is a detailed response to the well-funded official and semi-official attempts to debunk the 9/11 truth movement. In his most recent book, 9/11 Contradictions, an Open Letter to Congress and the Press, published in March of this year, focuses on serious internal contradictions within the official story. You could probably tell there, Dr. Griffin, I was reading that.
Oh, I just thought you had a great memory.
No, just sitting here reading it. Nice to talk to you again. We haven't spoken for a number of years. I think it's been 3 or 4 since you and I spoke last. Over the weekend, I had a chance to watch a documentary from 911mysteries.com entitled Part 1, Demolitions. And it was fascinating, regardless, I think, of one's position on 9/11, watching the this almost 2-hour-long film about the demolitions of those three buildings was, for me, a real eye-opener. Are you familiar with that film?
Well, yes, and in fact, I appear for a minute in the new version of it. So, yeah, oh. I'm quite familiar with it.
Okay. let me ask you this. So let's just start here.
But I should say, I should have said a little more. It really is. Sophia, who put it out, is a very careful.
She's the producer, writer.
Right. Uh huh.
Voice. I believe she did the voiceover, right?
And she did the voice, and she spent about $100,000 of her own money to do this. So that shows the kind of dedication that some people in the movement have. So I'm glad you recommended it because it is indeed an eye opener to many people. There, once they see it, there's simply no questioning that explosives brought these buildings down.
It is extremely difficult. We may have this young woman on the program later on this week. When you say the movement, you just said people in the movement. Why has it taken on the aspects of a movement the contradictory opinions regarding what happened on 9/11, contradictory to those of the governments?
Well, it's a movement because we can't get any attention, at least favorable or even neutral attention from the mainstream press. And when you get that kind of complete silence, it creates a movement, and particularly when you've got very strong evidence. And as I say in the beginning of debunking 9/11 debunking, the evidence that 9/11 was an inside job is overwhelming. The only problem is to get people to look at the evidence. We find time and time again that people who have ignored the evidence almost deliberately, like Bill Christensen, the former senior CIA analyst, admitted that for several years he had deliberately refused to look at the evidence. When he finally did, he said it was obvious that the official story about the towers, for example, was false. So when you get that kind of combination of very strong evidence plus simply a refusal by the mainstream media or the government to deal with your questions, then you get a movement.
Mm-hmm. Why, two-part question, why the silence from the mainstream media around the contradictions or the opposing point of view to the government's, the Bush administration's point of view, why that silence, A, B, and why the refusal to look at what people in the movement call evidence?
Well, you know, this is the kind of question that the appropriate answer is to say you need to ask them. And I wish you would. Ask some of the biggies. Ask Brian Williams. Ask the anchors for the various shows.
What do you think their answer would be?
Well, of course, this would be speculation.
Yes.
And what their answer would be might not be the truth.
Right.
So, you know, I can speculate as to why they're not covering the story. It would go all the way from one end of the spectrum would be simply that we can take them at face value that they don't believe in conspiracies, and so mm-hmm. they don't want to give credence to conspiracy theories. But, of course, we know that's not true. They report conspiracies all the time. A conspiracy is simply when two or more people agree to do something illegal. And we have all sorts of reports, from bank robberies to Enron chiseling their investors and all sorts of conspiracies. So there's something special about this conspiracy theory. Another kind of answer would be, well, it would create great lack of faith in America, and it might destroy the global economy if it were revealed that 9/11 was indeed an inside job. Another kind of answer would be, if you want to get more conspiratorial, they were in on it. And, you know, when you realize that MSNBC is, of course, NBC in general, is owned by General Electric,
mm-hmm.
and General Electric is getting very rich off of these wars, and, of course, that's a very old mm-hmm. story about war profiteers. It's very unfortunate that we have people that our mainstream media is owned by people who profit from wars. So it could be that kind of answer. And, of course, that is not the kind of answer that Tom Brokaw or Brian Williams would give you.
You've said, I believe, and I'm paraphrasing here, but I think you've said that the events of 9/11 do, in fact, constitute or are part of or constitute a religious issue. What do you mean by that?
Well, this question comes up quite a bit because, you know, what's a nice theologian like you doing mucking around in this kind of conspiracy theory? And why is this a theological or a religious issue? Well, if you're a theist, as I am, and believe that the world is created by a good, loving creator who loves all people equally, and in fact is interested in preserving all the life forms that have been created over the billions of years of evolution on our planet, and don't want those various life forms destroyed within our century, which is what is quite likely if we continue the present trajectory. Why, there could be no issue more important than revealing a plot which has been used to sidetrack concern with the global warming and the more general ecological crisis. You know, when the Cold War was over, we suddenly were talking about this big peace dividend, which we would now spend all this money that we've been using to defeat the commies to health, education, the environment. And suddenly, then we started getting these new wars. We suddenly attacked Panama. We tricked Saddam into invading Kuwait. And then 9/11 came. And, of course, the Project for the New American Century had said in their 2000 document, now that the Cold War is over, we shouldn't cut back on military spending. We should increase it. And of course, that's what's happened. And no concern whatsoever has been devoted to solving the global ecological crisis. Our excuse earlier had been, after the Rio convention, the Earth Summit, well, we couldn't afford it. Well, we're spending more money in Iraq than it would have taken, according to the Earth Summit, to solve the ecological crisis.
We have a break coming here, Professor Griffin, but I want to ask you when we come back, what, in your opinion, was the real purpose of the 9/11 Commission? I think most people, most reasonable people can agree, in light of what that commission produced and some of the dissenting opinion and subsequent revelations, that they were not there to really get the truth out. So when we come back, if you don't mind holding on for a moment, when we come back, I'm going to ask you what that 9/11 commission was all about. We're talking to David Ray Griffin. Stay with us. I'm Mike Molloy. This is Nova M.
Don't go to bed angry. Let Mike Molloy do it for you on Nova M Radio.
Past the hour. We're talking with David Ray Griffin, Professor David Ray Griffin, about 9/11 truth. Right before the break, that question, Dr. Griffin, what in your opinion was the real purpose of the 9/11 Commission, if not to get the truth of the events of that day out before the American public?
Well, it was to appear to get the truth out to the American public so that people would move on and not raise any more questions. But the other side of it was, of course, to conceal the truth about what really happened on 9/11. The the executive director, of course, was Philip Zelikow. People have mistakenly assumed that the commission was run by Lee Hamilton and Thomas Kane, mm-hmm. The chair and co-chair. But as Philip Sheenan's book, Philip Sheenan, of course, is the New York Times reporter who was assigned to 9/11 and recently put out a book called The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. And he points out what we in the movement had already pointed out, that the 9/11 Commission was really run by the executive director, Philip Zelikow, and that he was essentially a member of the Bush White House. He had been with Condi Rice on the National Security Council during the first President Bush reign. Then they wrote a book together while the Republicans were out of office. Then she brought him on to help with the transition from the Clinton to the new Bush White House. She even, and this was an astounding fact, she brought him on to write National Security Strategy of the United States of America 2002, which was really, as Sheenan puts out, the document that was used to justify the attack on Iraq. So here we have a guy who was fully on board and, mm-hmm. and really a part of the Bush White House, leading the investigation, which should have been asking, among other things, whether the Bush White House was responsible for 9/11, whether through incompetence or through mm-hmm. complicity.
Well, I can certainly understand that to be the case about not just Zelikow, but so many members of this commission. And their party affiliation really is kind of immaterial. When you're involved in a cover-up, I think the people selected for the commission have... their party affiliation really doesn't mean anything. And yet that leaves one member of that commission that, to me, it seems kind of incredible, I think is the word I would choose, incredible, that he would participate in a deliberate refusal to go after the truth. And, of course, I'm referring to Richard Benveniste, one of the Watergate prosecutors. I can remember, I'm sure you probably do too, Benveniste's intense, focused questioning of some of the key figures in the Watergate hearings that led to Nixon resigning. How would someone like Benveniste be involved in turning his face away from wherever the questions might lead? For example, the appearance before the commission of Bush and Cheney hand in hand and not under oath. How did Benveniste, this top litigator, agree to go along with that sort of thing?
Well, I don't know. Again, that's a question it would be good for you to ask him. One reporter did ask him a question after one of the early 9/11 commission hearings, saying, we're told that Muhammad Atta, the alleged ringleader, was a devout Muslim, and yet here we have mainstream news reports of him not only drinking alcohol and going to sex clubs, but also snorting cocaine. How do you explain this? And right. Benveniste said, well, that's a heck of a question. Well, it was a heck of a question that the 9/11 Commission never answered. Benveniste went along with the answer that Muhammad Atta was a devout Muslim.
Professor Griffin, can I get you a hold on again?
Okay.
All right, we have to do a break here. We'll come back right after this break and continue the conversation with Professor David Ray Griffin of the 9/11 Truth Movement. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.
I was flying on UA-93. That shadow in the footage, it was probably me. I'm the rumor, I'm the doubt, I'm the lie. But you wouldn't stand near me if you didn't want to die. Everything you know is wrong.
Misinformation.
There's a verse missing out of this song.
Misinformation.
Everything you know is wrong.
didn't connect the dots. How come the dots weren't connected? Well, the Patriot Act helps us connect the dots. It is inexcusable to say, on the one hand, connect the dots and not give us a chance to do so. We've connected the dots, or trying to connect the dots.
Shut up. Oh, my God. 25 before the hour, Malloy here on Nova M Radio. We're talking with Professor David Ray Griffin, one of the leading lights in the 9/11 truth movement. Why is it important, Dr. Griffin, for the American people to know and to accept, I guess, eventually, whatever truth of the 9/11 event there may be out there, assuming there's nothing we could do about it? And now I'm not saying that there is nothing we could do about it, but let's assume that our institutions now have been so corrupted, and our will, we have learned helplessness now. Why is it important in and of itself for us to know the truth about 9/11? Is there any reward there, any value there?
Well, certainly knowing the truth is a good thing, you know, in and of itself. But also, it does have instrumental value. For one thing, if there is another such attack, and that is not out of the question, the more people who know that 9/11 was a false flag attack orchestrated to justify attacking Muslim countries that have our oil buried underneath them, as our leaders tend to think, the harder it will be for them to get away with it. And perhaps at some point, political leaders in the Senate and the Congress will say, enough's enough, and will hold an investigation and bring the truth out. Maybe at some point the mainstream media might even say, enough's enough, and you know, so many people are on board with what happened. Maybe we better get out in front, and so we can take credit for revealing the truth. So there are all sorts of possibilities, but it is, from my point of view, of overwhelming importance that that the truth become exposed and become part of our public consciousness. You know, we could get up to the point where 60 or so more people knew, or at least strongly suspected, that 9/11 had been an inside job. But if it's not publicly discussed, it doesn't affect the national policy.
Yeah, I think that 60% figure is just about there, isn't it? Doesn't that number kind of float to the surface whenever there is a non-mainstream media survey taken about how many people believe the truth of the 9/11 Commission, how many people do not? Isn't that number already either in the high 50s or approaching 60%?
Yeah, I think depending on how it's worded, if you word it to say, do you believe the full truth has been told, or do you think there has been a cover-up, you get very high figures up in the 60s and 70s. If you word it, do you believe 9/11 was an inside job, you get a lower number. So there are many people who believe they've lied about it, but they may think they're lying about incompetence, or they may think they're lying about having just sort of let it happen. So you do get different figures. So yeah, I was suggesting if we got up to 60 who believed it was an inside job, that would be a very high figure. But you know, we have those kind of figures and higher for the JFK assassination. And yet that is not part of our public discussion. You don't hear people on the nightly news saying, well, of course, when our CIA participated in the assassination of Kennedy, that isn't done, and therefore it doesn't affect policy, and it can't be used then as a precedent to say that, well, here's another one of these inside jobs that the government has lied to us about.
I have another one of those. It might be better for you, Mike Malloy, to ask him the questions. One of the staunchest, if that's the word, anti-imperialist in this country, the linguist Noam Chomsky, who I have deep respect for, have been reading his works for probably 35 years now. Chomsky is totally against any idea, my understanding is, there may be some nuance there that I'm not aware of, but he seems to be totally against any idea of a conspiracy or a plot to that involved the government, the government of the United States, either on a basis of the U.S. government made this event occur or the U.S. government let it occur. How would you explain, and again, a purely rhetorical question, how would you explain Noam Chomsky's refusal to adopt the conspiracy idea around this event?
Well, like you say, that would be a good question for you to ask him, but of course a lot of people have asked him, and he tends to give the same kinds of answers. I like you, have learned an enormous amount from him. I think I've read virtually every one of his books. And, you know, two of his closest friends, Howard Zinn and Richard Falk, have endorsed my
right
works. Why he is so, but he seems to be completely beyond empiricism on here. In fact, I do, in my debunking 9/11, I discuss people in terms of three kinds of minds. There are empirical minds who say, well, this may be hard for me to believe, but show me the evidence and I'll accept it.
Mm-hmm.
You've got paradigmatic minds who say that, you know, I know how the world works, and this doesn't fit, and so I don't need to look at the evidence. I know it didn't happen. And Chomsky seems to be a very strong paradigmatic thinker.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to refuse to look at the evidence. Richard Falk encouraged him to read my book when it was when it was just ready to come out, the New Pearl Harbor. He said he would not read it. He told somebody, somebody just revealed to me who had been corresponding with him, that Chomsky didn't even know that Building 7 had not been hit by an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
He seems deliberately to refuse to look at any of the evidence. So the evidence about explosions in the towers, which is abundant. You know, we've got at least 118 of the firefighters and emergency medical workers who reported these. That's the best I can come up with. Now, some people suspect his motives. I do not. I think he's an honest truth seeker, but, you know, he refused to accept the evidence about JFK as well, and the evidence there is also very, very strong. But if you don't look at the evidence, you can reject it. And he keeps raising the bar. He first said, well, you know, you don't have any scientists who support this view. Well, then we got Stephen Jones and some other physicists. And he said, well, physicists aren't really important here. What you need are structural engineers. Now we've got hundreds of architects and structural engineers. And then he raises the bar and says, well, you know, you've got to have something published in a peer-reviewed journal.
Mm-hmm.
If what you're saying is true, you could get this. Well, you know, it's not necessarily true, but then Stephen Jones did get an article in a peer-reviewed journal, and Chomsky has not been impressed.
That's interesting. I wasn't aware of his specific objection to this. Might be based on the fact that he's not completely aware of what 9/11 Truth Movement has put together. What about this? There seems to be a dividing line among some people who are willing to take a look at what's available right now about the events of that day, whether it was the collapse of the buildings or the failure to for our defenses to respond or the activities of Cheney or whatever. But it seems to break down people who are convinced that something other than what was in the official report happened. Breaks down into two groups. Those who think the Bush administration engineered this event, or in other words, made it happen, and those that believe the Bush administration refused to intervene, in other words, let it happen. Do you have a position on that?
Well, that was the case within the movement in the early stages, the so-called distinction between the lie-hop and the my-hop, making it happen, letting it happen.
Mm-hmm.
But and that's still the case within the general population. But as far as people in the movement who've looked at the evidence, that distinction virtually doesn't exist anymore, because so much of the evidence, and the strongest evidence, is of things that show that it had to be orchestrated, it had to be engineered, it had to be have made to been happen by the White House and the Pentagon and its intelligence agencies.
It's almost impossible, isn't it, to for one to get one's mind around that, what you just said. Could you hold on one more break here, Professor, and then we have a short segment, and then I think that'll be it for tonight. Can you do that?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. We're talking with David Ray Griffin. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
Redefining Anger Management. It's Mike Malloy, only on Nova M Radio.
That's where we are. 10 before the hour, we're talking with Professor David Ray Griffin of the 9/11 Truth Movement. How does the let me put this in as non-inflammatory way as I can, Professor Griffin. How does the the idea that there was a cover-up, as opposed to the idea that there was not a cover-up. I think you'll agree with me. A lot of people believe in this country that the events that occurred on that day are as have been reported. There is an equal or perhaps greater number of people who refuse to accept that. How does that dissension, that is truly a fault line in this society. On the one side are people who believe that our own government engineered a horrific attack against us. On the other side are people who say that is nonsense. How will that ongoing conflict regarding 9/11 affect some of our essential institutions, like our political system, academia, to a lesser extent, perhaps theological points of view? How does that schism, if you will, work in?
Well, it's extremely unhealthy to have that kind of division in the country, and that's one of the many motives for those of us who try to get the truth exposed. My latest book is an attempt to go at this in a different way. Rather than arguing that 9/11 was an inside job, as I have done in earlier books,
mm-hmm.
In this book, 9/11 Contradictions, an open letter to Congress and the press, and by the way, we sent the books to most members of Congress, I simply lay out contradictions. So we all know that a story can't be true if it's self-contradictory. You know, if the 9/11 Commission says Cheney went down to the underground bunker at 9:58 and Mineta says no, he was down there already by 9:20, one of them isn't telling the truth. And we've got I lay out 25 contradictions of that nature, and it shows people that something without raising the question of conspiracy, without raising any theory at all, it just shows something is terribly wrong with the official story if it is riddled with 25 major self-contradictions.
Well, I was just going to say, can any of those contradictions be excused, if that's the right word, as a different point of view brought about by the confusion of the moment. I don't think anyone, except if there were major conspirators within the government who understood perfectly well what was going on, I think most people were unaware of what was going on. Could some of those contradictions be simply confusion? If someone were to, I could insist that my daughter in Florida called me at 9:10 on that morning and said, "Dad, are you watching CNN? You better turn it on." And my wife may say, "No, it was actually 9:40 when your daughter Libby called." So, can any of those contradictions be excused that way?
I think if you actually read the book, you'll see that that would be highly implausible. To take this one example, what did the 9/11 Commission do with Mineta's testimony? This was testimony that he gave to the 9/11 Commission in open testimony.
That was the Secretary of Transportation, Norman Mineta.
That's right.
Okay.
He said he got to the White House at about 9:15, was told to go down to the underground bunker where Cheney was in charge. Mm-hmm. And he got down there, and yes, Cheney was already there. And then he told this story about the young man coming in, saying the plane is a few miles out and so on.
Right.
And what the 9/11 Commission do with that, they completely deleted Mineta's statement and even deleted it from the official record. If you go on in the 9/11, so these are not accidents. This mm-hmm. was deliberately deleted. Let me give you another example. Bush in the classroom. We all know from Michael Moore's movie Fahrenheit 9/11 that after Bush was told that by Andy Card that the second tower had been hit, America is under attack, that he sat there for 8 or 9 more minutes. What did the White House do on the first anniversary of 9/11? They started telling a new story. They said, and Andy Card was telling the story, saying, "I whispered in the president's ear, and he sat there just a few seconds and immediately got up and excused himself and left the room."
Right.
These are not faulty memory problems.
No, that one certainly isn't.
And if you read the others, you'll see they're all of the same nature of deliberately refusing to acknowledge testimony that was given. These are all internal contradictions, by people within who are telling the official story. So, no, they can't be excused as mere faulty memory lapses.
For people who didn't write that down, the title is 9/11 Contradictions, an Open Letter to Congress and the Press. And it's my understanding it just came out a couple of months ago. Is that right?
Yeah, and I was glad you said that debunking 9/11 was my best book. It certainly was up till then, but now many people are saying this is the best one.
Well, I can't wait to contact your publisher and beg for a free copy.
I will beg for it. I will have it sent to you right away.
We're just about out of time. I just want to thank you again. I hope we can talk again, Professor Griffin. An hour on a talk radio program is really about 34 minutes, so we don't get a whole lot, as far as I'm concerned, a whole lot of ground covered. If you can give me a 5-second answer, what do you think the American people should do to halt this move towards war with Iran? And I mean literally 10 seconds here.
Well, write their congressman, write letters to the editor, and study the facts about 9/11 so you know the whole thing is a lie.
David Ray Griffin, professor, Dr. David Ray Griffin, thanks a lot for being our guest tonight.
Thank you, Mike.
All right, we'll talk again. Take care, sir. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio. Welcome back. 7 past the hour. Malloy here on the Nova radio network. Hillary Clinton said the OPEC cartel can no longer be a cartel. This is interesting. Where is she? Where'd she say this? Do you know where she says this? Was it in Indiana? She attacked oil prices as being artificially inflated. Oh, really? And today she appeared to threaten to break up the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC. She said at a rally in Indiana, quote, "We're going to go right at OPEC. They can no longer be a cartel, a monopoly that get together once every couple of months in some conference room in some plush place in the world. They decide how much oil they're going to produce and what price they're going to put it at." End quote. Has someone told Hillary Clinton that OPEC doesn't determine what the price is going to be? OPEC determines how much they're going to pump. And then the commodities markets, the global commodities markets, the speculators determine the price. Has someone not told Senator Clinton that? She went on to say, quote, "That's not a market, that's a monopoly." End quote. And she said she'd use antitrust law and the World Trade Organization to take on OPEC. How? Antitrust laws pertain to corporations in the United States, I believe. Mm. And the World Trade Organization is it not about to tamper with OPEC, any OPEC nation, or any non-OPEC oil-producing nation for one simple reason. Supply and demand. Oh, never mind. Clinton is trying to cast herself as a warrior for working people against the oil industry. It's her message to people in Indiana is potent, like the attack on Wall Street money brokers. The oil cartel. Yeah, this is not a new argument. I can remember my grandfather when he was in his 70s, and I was what, 10, telling me, and he owned a what was quaintly referred to back in the day as a filling station and a tire company in a small town in Ohio, and he used to say to me that what did he say to me? He said something to me. Oh, that's right. He used to tell me about the Wall Street money brokers and how they had a death grip on the American public. He never used the word consumers. I don't know. Maybe he didn't say that because he spoke very poor English. So maybe he was really talking to me about playing the new game that he had just bought called Parcheesi. I have no idea, but it sounded like he was trying to tell me something about Standard Oil of New York, I think was the big issue to him. Standard Oil of New York, even though by that time it had been broken up. and the Rocket, was it the Rockefeller family? I don't know. Maybe he was talking about Parcheesi. Out of hell with it. But I just remember my grandfather was, since he was an Italian who was born before the turn of the 20th century, he was inherently an anarchist. He was a capitalist anarchist. Figure that one out. Which simply means he hated everybody. The Obama campaign points out that Clinton has not signed on to co-sponsor a bill that tries to, quote, make oil producing and exporting cartels illegal, end quote. What? To make them illegal? Well, no, wait a minute. Let me get this straight. The U.S. House and Senate has introduced legislation that will make them illegal? And that means what? What follows right after that? Okay, they become illegal. What do we do? Send in the Marines. Oh, I get it. That's right. Send in the Marines. Does the rest of the world then step up and say, Hey, Venezuela, hey, Saudi Arabia, hey, Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, wherever, we'll take your oil. We don't think it's illegal. We think, what is going on in the United States of crazy? What is going on here? Make oil producing and exporting cartels illegal. Oh, well, that's a wonderful idea. Let's check back on that one in about, 6 months and see how it's working. I know I'm on the tail end of a hurricane here, but they're still talking about Barack Obama's former preacher, aren't they? What's his name, Wright? And I just wonder how much longer this putrid, whorish media that we have to deal with is going to continue to give John McCain a free pass where it concerns Hagee and Sour or Parsley, whatever the hell his name is. I hate these preacher freaks anyway. Hagee's, it started out with Hagee is demonizing Catholics and Catholicism. To the extent that he did, you know, the Catholic Church is a whore. That's pretty rough there, Pastor. But anyway, you may be right. He appeared on Fresh Air. Oh, excuse me. My sinuses are swelling up again. He appeared on Terry Gross's Fresh Air radio show. And he also said in his 2006 bestseller, Jerusalem Countdown, that God will incinerate most Americans now living with a nuclear strike on America's coastal regions. That's right. And McCain, about a year ago, appeared to hold a similar view on possible outcomes of a war with Iran. In an April 2nd, 2006 appearance on Meet the Press, McCain describing to Tim Russert his view of the possible results of a war with Iran, declared that that war could be Armageddon. Hagee and Rod Parsley, what a name. Rod, first name gives, Parsley, the second name takes away. Rod Parsley. Ow! Also recently it's come to light that John Hagee declared, America is under the curse of God. Now when Jeremy, I don't know why I'm talking about this. I really don't, and I apologize, but I just want to anyway, okay? Indulge me. It's because of the ass-whipping that Barack Obama has been taking because the media in this country are just sucky whores. They're horrible. They're disgusting. They consist of people like Tim Russert and Brian Williams and Chris Matthews and and all these people who have no interest in providing anything for us except death cage matches or whatever. But Hagee declared that America is under the curse of God. And he says that the majority of Americans and the majority of Jews are all going to die. Hagee really hates Jews. He only is using them as a fulfillment of prophecy. According to Hagee, only 144,000 Jews are ever going to make it into Christianity anyway. That's 12,000 for each of the original 12 tribes. And the rest of the Jews are going to what, Mr. Hagee? Oh, that's right. They're all going to die. Okay. Sorry, I forgot. He appeared on Fresh Air and began with an excerpt from one of his radio sermons in which he enthusiastically declares that a chain of events he expects will follow a U.S. or Israeli attack on Iran, which includes what he calls Ezekiel's war and the rapture, and that all this would be thrilling. That's his word, thrilling. Hagee said in the interview with Terry Gross that during Ezekiel's war, God will cause a Russian nuclear strike on America that will destroy the East Coast and the West Coast.
Bigglesbush. When Georgie falls asleep, I creep into the Oval Office, sneak a ciggy, and turn on Mike Malloy. Then I reprogram Georgie's speed dial. The simple pleasures.
Yeah, simple. If you want to get David Ray Griffin's book, the newest one, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, very easy way you can do this. Go to tvnewslies.org, a website that most of you are familiar with. If you're not, you should be. tvnewslies.org, and click the donations section. I think you can get it with a donation. I think you can get it for $14, I think. You can go to tvnewslies.org and figure it out yourself. But there it is. Just click the donations section of tvnewslies.org, and the book is readily available. You don't have to go through a whole bunch of hassle to get it. Okay. You want to do that? You heard me make a blatant, scummy pitch for a free copy. Well, tough. That's one of the few fringe benefits of working in this business. You get a free book now and then. The other thing about Hagee, and I just wish that the mainstream media would question John McCain just one-tenth of the extent that they have harassed Barack Obama about Jeremiah Wright. If they would just harass McCain just a little bit about Hagee and Rod Parsley. I mean, these are two preachers who tell you that, I just don't know where to start. This is outrageous stuff. Hagee says that Hurricane Katrina was judgment of God against the city of New Orleans because they were going to have a gay pride parade the next day. And nobody in mainstream media talks about that. Jeremiah Wright says that the attack on this country on September 11th were another example of the chickens coming home to roost because of acts of terror that we've committed around the globe. And all these anchor people and reporters and these scum on television sit there with just these shocked looks on their, what? We've committed acts of terror? Oh, my God. Boy, is that a lie. What is wrong with you people? What do you call it? What do you call a 5, 6, 7 year long, and I know it's longer than that, I'm just talking about the Reagan administration's involvement, war of terror against the people of Central America, where not 6,000 or 3,000 died, not 6, not 10, not 100,000, but closer to a quarter of a million people were wiped out because of U.S. foreign policy. I mean, what do you call that if you don't call it terror? What do you call it when 8, 9, 10,000 Panamanians are incinerated because George W. Herbert Walker Bush wants to get his hands on Manuel Noriega before Noriega spills the beans on the use of Panama as a drug transshipment point and his involvement as a CIA operative, Noriega's? What do you call that? What do you call it when thousands of people are disappeared in the Philippines in order to support the government of Marcos? What do you call that? What do you call the overthrow of the government of Iran in 1953 and the installation of the Shah, and then the creation of the Savak, a torture secret police unit that then goes to work on the Iranian people for the next 30 years? What do you call that? Jesus Christ, what do you call it if not terror? What do you call free fire zones in Vietnam, a country that did nothing to us? What do you call that? Well, without getting hysterical, you call it terrorism. And the United States is and has been, for a number of decades, if not centuries, the leading exporter of terrorism and the committer of terrorism around the planet. Come on. Damn. Okay. The Soviet Union, Stalin. Internal terrorism, monstrous amounts of it. Okay. China, internal terrorism, monstrous. Germany, maybe a close second to the United States, or would they be first? But the United States? Come on, people. Jesus, God. Spanish-American War, a new weapon called the Gatling gun. This is reported by Mark Twain when he was a war correspondent. rounding up in the Philippines, there was the Spanish government, two guerrilla groups, and we supported one guerrilla group, and the other guerrilla group we knew we had to get rid of because we couldn't control it. So the rounding up of people in the villages in the Philippines in the Spanish-American War, and sending hundreds of people into the cone, is that what you call it, the concave part of a dormant volcano. And then setting up U.S. Marines around the perimeter and opening fire with the new invention, Gatling guns, to see how many people you could kill how quickly. Did that really happen? Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens said it did. The supporting of terrorism by the Israeli Defense Forces against the Palestinian people in that sad, ripped-to-pieces country. Is that terrorism? Yeah. So Jeremiah Wright talks about this stuff. And people like the Joe Scarborough and Chris Matthews and the rest of these thugs sit there and go, well, he accused the United States of terrorism. How could that be? The question is, how could these people be so damn ignorant?
Than a flying monkey, more powerful than a special prosecutor. It's Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio.
26 before the hour, just for a moment here, I'm focusing on two of John McCain's spiritual advisors, people that he, whose endorsement he sought, and people he claims advised him spiritually, Rod Parsley and John Hagee, who are sick, corrupted individuals who want death and destruction so they can have their little funhouse in the sky with their buddy Jesus if enough people die here. Hagee is one of those who believe that most Jews are going to be slaughtered in this conflict between good and evil, or Christian and Jew, or whatever this sick bastard thinks about. I just can't get my mind around these people. Hagee goes on to say that the Jews will be given one chance, and when Jesus arrives to convert to Christianity or have their throats cut, and of course Hagee is hoping for the throat cutting part. He also, his statements about God judging the city of New Orleans because they're going to have a gay pride parade. So instead of having the parade, the sick, putrid God of his sent a hurricane to flood the city. What else? Hagee also says the military will have difficulty recruiting healthy, strong heterosexuals for combat purposes. Why? Fighting in combat with a man in your foxhole that has AIDS or is HIV positive is double jeopardy. This sick son of a bitch, does he understand that foxholes is something that he sees in World War II movies late at night? What? He goes on, Hagee also says, gay marriage will open the door to incest, polygamy, and every conceivable marriage arrangement demented minds can possibly conceive. If God does not then punish America, he will have to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah. Oh, John, please kill yourself. Please, please. Could you go visit God? Please. He goes on to say, it is impossible to call yourself a Christian and defend homosexuality. There is no justification or acceptance of homosexuality. Homosexuality means the death of society because homosexuals can recruit, but they cannot reproduce. Will somebody tell Hagee that lesbian women can have... Oh, Christ, never mind. Hagee also says in his book, what every man wants in a woman... Only a spirit-filled woman can submit to her husband's lead. It is the natural desire of a woman to lead through feminine manipulation of the man. Fallen women will try to dominate the marriage. The man has the God-given role to be the loving leader of the home. Kathy? Oh, never mind. Hey,
were you talking?
No, no. Now, how come nobody brings this stuff up about Hagee, the sick little worm? Why did nobody bring it up? He's written books. He's got, you know, he talks about, he's going to see all the Jews slaughtered. Women are nothing but whores, except the ones that submit to their lord and master in the house. Homosexuals can't reproduce, but they can only recruit. Gay marriage opens the door to all kinds of stuff. The military is going to have a hard time recruiting healthy, strong, heterosexual. Oh, God. And Hurricane Katrina was God's way of punishing New Orleans. Now, Rod Parsley, in his book, Silent No More, he says, I cannot tell you how important it is we understand the true nature of Islam, that we see it for what it really is. In fact, I will tell you this. I do not believe our country can truly fulfill its divine purpose until we understand our historical conflict with Islam. I know that this statement sounds extreme, but I don't shrink from its implications. The fact is that America was founded in part with the intention of seeing this false religion destroyed. Really? America was... Oh, okay. Then Parsley gets into the part that he really loves, and that's gay sex. He says, gay sexuality inevitably involves brutal physical abusiveness and the unnatural imposition of alien substances into internal organs, orally and anally, that inevitably suppress the immune system and heighten susceptibility to disease. Oh, my God. What does Parsley do? Sit around and write this stuff and then read it? And yeah, that's right. And he also writes, only 1%... I love this one. Only 1% of the homosexual population in America will die of old age. The average life expectancy for a homosexual in the United States is 43. A lesbian can only expect to live to be 45. Homosexuals represent 2% of the population, yet they carry 60% of the known cases of syphilis. Son of a bitch. And it just goes on and on. I mean... what has happened to my country? What has happened to your country? That these religious vermin have taken over to this extent. You get somebody like Jeremiah Wright, who speaks pretty much the truth. Well, what did Jeremiah Wright say that is not true? The things that white people don't think are true that Jeremiah Wright said, like Malcolm X or the Farrakhan. God, too much antihistamine. That Farrakhan is a great American. You know, a lot of blacks look at that, a lot of Jews look at that and say, "You're out of your freaking mind." But to somebody like certain elements of the black community, sure, maybe it's true. So what? See, I don't know. So what? A lot of people think Lech Walesa was a great revolutionary leader. A lot of other people think he's a Catholic freakoid. It just goes on and on and on and on. But here's Pastor Hagee and Pastor Parsley. Pastor Parsley. Never mind. Here's Pastor Parsley and Pastor Hagee. How far did you go? Well, I got Pastor Hagee. You did? These two nutballs saying the kind of stuff that they say, and nobody challenges McCain on his seeking their support. What does this mean? And yet they continue to roast, to deep fry Barack Obama and his wife because of Jeremiah Wright. Oh, I can't. Pastor Hagee. Oh, Lord have mercy. Why do I take any of this seriously at all? I guess because I know that these people could have me killed tomorrow. That's why I take it seriously. What is this? Shops, condos, and hotels planned for the Green Zone in Baghdad? This is a joke. Is this from The Onion? Forget the rocket attacks, concrete blast walls, and lack of a sewer system. Try to imagine luxury hotels, a shopping center, and condos in the heart of Baghdad. That's all part of a five-year development dream list to transform the U.S. Protected Green Zone into a centerpiece for Baghdad's future. The $5 billion plan has the backing of the Pentagon. This has got to be from The Onion. Associated Press? Marriott International? No, don't go there, Malloy. It's too late in the evening. You're still dealing with the dregs of this cold, and you don't want to lose your mind, not tonight. Luxury hotels and shopping malls in the green zone. Probably a place where you can go buy crispied babies and heads that have been lopped off, and what else? Charred body parts, huh? Did you get enough of Jeremiah Wright, though? I don't want to hear about Pastor Hagee or Pastor Parsley on television. These people ought to be condemned to some little room someplace where they can sit and try to save each other from their own personal demons. I want to hear real news. But the fact is, Jeremiah Wright became the Gary Condit. Remember what it took to get Gary Condit's story off of television? He was a hot topic all summer. It just never stopped. And then all of a sudden, oops, while these pig rat bastards were talking about Gary Condit instead of doing their job, somebody in the U.S. government or its accomplices or not were engineering the greatest attack on American soil since the War of 1812. And all of a sudden, Gary Condit, Chandra Levy, huh? Remember how quickly... All of a sudden, wall-to-wall, remember, the biggest offender, of course, with them was MSNBC. Wall-to-wall. It never stopped until all of a sudden we had 3,000 dead people in Midtown Manhattan, or in Lower Manhattan. Boom. Then, it's the same with the Jeremiah Wright story. What's it going to take to finally get it off? Is it finally off? Is it going to take, the Republicans are just waiting. Skunk, filthy, dirt-eating, dung-eating clods that they are, how many videos do you think have already been prepared to tie forever Barack Obama to Jeremiah Wright? And in the meantime, John McCain will continue to get his free pass, even though his spiritual advisors talk about slaughtering the Jews who don't accept Jesus as their Lord and personal Savior and drink from the cup and eat from the body and so on and so forth. And even the Jews that say yes, if you had 500,000 Jews said, okay, I'll sign up for that. Pastor Hagee would sit there and say, no, 360,000 of you are going to have to step aside because we only want 144,000. That's all that's allowed according to the Bible. And the Jews would be like, what are you talking about? We're ready to convert. No, sorry, you have got to die. Huh? But Pastor Hagee, we thought you were on our side. Oh, well, you were supposed to think that. You're a Jew. What? I'm going to treat you seriously? Of course I wanted you to think that. Until the rapture. Well, the rapture's here. You notice my clothes are gone? Huh? Take a look. Here I go. I'm going up. See you later, Jews. Hey, too bad you didn't convert. It's a shame. Woo! God damn, it's cold up here. is 9 before the hour. Thanks to the crew, Ian Huff, who engineered the program, and I was going to say answer your calls tonight, but I don't think we took any calls tonight, did we? What does he do when we don't do it? He sits there and does crossword puzzles or something? Good God. Anyway, thanks to Ian for engineering the program, Billy Foster, our technical director, Ben Birch, our podcast manager, Chris in Minnesota, our senior correspondent, and Sharon Gordy, our military affairs correspondent, Bob Alexander, resident philosopher, Bridget Wolf, writer-in-residence, Catherine Bay, our executive producer. And if you haven't become a founding member of Nova M Radio at NovaMRadio.com, check it out, will you? Check it out. Oh, my goodness. We have somebody holding on. Well, it's RB from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, holding on for over 2 hours. Sorry, RB. Are you there? He fell asleep.
Hi.
Oh, hello.
Do you need... his wife. He just stepped out for a minute to get our son, and he actually just wanted to commend you on your Truth 9/11 series tonight, and he wanted to let you know that he's going to Ottawa for the march in September for 9/11, and he's really pumped and looking forward to it.
All right. Do you need any help right now? Is there anything I can do? Should I send help?
Well, we are going to start forming a march group out here in Saskatoon.
Sure.
And you know what? Once we get our email up and running, because we just moved.
Yeah.
And he'll email you.
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks, Mrs. Right? Thanks, Mrs. RB. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Mike. Have a great night.
Thank you. Take care. Tell RB we said hello. Dick is calling from Seattle, listening on KPTK. Hey, Dick.
Yeah. Hey, Mike. Yeah. Well, first of all, it's great again that we're talking about 9/11.
Yeah.
I mean, if for no other reason, you know, just to crack this neocon door open a little and let some light shine into their dungeon of darkness and despair.
Yeah.
But I wanted to go to the question of how can we best explain those in the public who accept the official 9/11 lie when virtually everyone can find out that steel frame buildings have never collapsed in fires, let alone three in one place with only relatively small fires. And even when the owner of the World Trade Center admitted blowing up Building 7, you know, which fell with all the same characteristics of a controlled demolition, just as Buildings 2 and 1 did.
Right.
And of course, on top of this, we have all those eyewitnesses' accounts, you know, of the explosions going off prior to the building collapses.
Well, I don't know. I wish I had an answer to that question after watching this documentary over the weekend, 9/11 Mysteries, Part 1, Demolitions. I'm certainly not an engineer. I'm not a structural engineer, but I'm not a stupid man.
No, they blew the damn thing up, obviously.
And in watching what I saw with this documentary, and it wasn't a doctored documentary, it was a documentary about a horrific event. In watching this, I don't have any doubts that those buildings came down not as a result of the plane crashes, into them. Regardless of the truth or fiction of anything else about the events of 9/11, I have it settled in my head. After watching this, after listening to arguments on both sides, after reading the Popular Mechanics supposed disputation of all this, after going through all this, there's not a power on earth that can convince me any longer that the collapse of those three buildings was not the result of anything other than a controlled demolition. I have no doubt, and I'm not a structural engineer. I'm not a scientist. But like I said, I'm not a stupid person. So,
well, 9/11 isn't the first time for this sort of American Stockholm syndrome posturing. I mean, we did it before with a political assassination in the 60s, and then with the Pike and Church committee findings, and then we had the Iran-Contra hearings we covered up, and, of course, the theft of our presidential elections in 2004.
Yeah, you know, but this time they're telling the truth.
Yeah, you're right. And it's the same old story over and over again. Now, this is what we get from that. We get a corporate crime syndicate running our country. of the worst order.
As far as I'm concerned, there is nothing but truth to that statement, Dick. Thanks, man. We got to clear out of here pretty quickly. Thanks for checking in. Again, regarding the buildings collapsing, if you get this documentary, you can get information 911mysteries.com, 911mysteries.com. And I watched, it runs about 90 minutes, I watched part one, Demolitions. I don't care who you are, I don't care how made up your mind is, I don't care how smart you are, I don't care what your degree is in. Just go ahead, get this documentary and watch it and hold on to your convictions. That's all. I'm just asking that you hold on to your convictions and look at this film. And when the film is over, just, I don't know, drop me a line and tell me if your convictions remained intact. If they did, okay. If they didn't, if you have a different take on it, okay. I'm just curious. I'll see you tomorrow night, okay? Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.